I thought I had read all of Anne Lamott's novels until I happened upon this one that I somehow missed while browsing through the fiction section at the University of Chicago's bookstore, which was one of my chief sabbatical hangouts, as you can probably imagine. So I bought it, I took it back to the apartment I had there, and I read it through. One of the many good things about the sabbatical I recently completed was that if I came across a book I wanted to read, I just bought it and went back and read it all the way through without having to think about how much time I might have been taking away from other endeavors and responsibilities. Kind of a nice thing to be able to do. The book is titled Joe Jones. The title has no bearing at all on the passages from it that I'm going to be lifting up today. Like all of Ms. Lamott's novels, this one is set in a not quite locatable location in Marin County, California, just to the north of San Francisco. And it is written in that beautifully crafted way that reflects the author's love for that area. The bulk of the action in this piece takes place in and around a small short order diner restaurant called Jesse's Cafe, in one of the more rural areas of Marin. The two central characters are Willie and Louise. Willie's elderly mother, Jessie, owns the restaurant, hence the title, Jessie's Cafe. But she has handed over the operation to her son, Willie. Willie, while very sweet, usually good-natured, delightfully kind-hearted, doesn't quite have the makings of a restaurant operator, so Louise has been taken on for that role. The two of them, as this novel goes through, Willie and Louise keep this funky little establishment of a restaurant going. The fact that Willie is a gay man keeps their relationship platonic while still very close and loving. Early on in the story, Eva befriends a school teacher named Eva Dean after helping her fix a flat tire in a small town close by the restaurant. Eva is rather mysterious. She seems to have no close relationships with anybody, no significant other person in her life, no apparent family nearby. She's a kind of a lost soul whose life is bound up in her teaching. And Eva gradually begins to hang around Jesse's cafe. She kind of shows up on the edges and sits there and grades her paper and prepares her lesson plans and the like. She keeps mostly to herself, opening up only on occasion to Willie and Jesse. The reader gets the sense that she's holding on to a secret, which she is. Eva is dying. And she has no one in her life she can even talk with about her fate. No one, that is, until the day that she comes out, as it were, to Louise and Willie. The little restaurant has become her safe place, her sanctuary, if you will, where she feels she can express her bewilderment and her fear and her anger at all that has befallen her. And so I'm going to read the passage as Eva, Louise, and Willie converse after the restaurant closes for one evening. There are two things going very badly wrong. Eva sniffles, but she's no longer crying. One is that my husband left me for someone else several months ago, out of the blue. Oh, boy, Louise says sadly and squeezes Eva's shoulder. And I mean, that's the good news, Eva says. Willie looks like he could cry. Eva bends forward and stares blearily into her glass of port. I'm very, very sick, she says. Louise cranes her head forward, peering at Eva. Really? Eva nods. What is it? I don't want to tell you. All right. It's not cancer, but it's just as bad. I was better for a while, but now I'm getting sick again. And I'm so angry, I can't handle it. But everything else will go on. People coming and going here at the cafe, everywhere, eating, singing, the tides. But it's going to go on without me. Eva hunches forward with her shoulders in tight, protecting her head. It's clear to Louise she doesn't want to be touched. We'll protect you, Willie says. How can you protect me from death, Willie? Maybe you'll get better. No, I can't get better.
Are you sure?
Uh-huh. Louise sighs. Boy, she says. Boy yourself. Eva shuts her eyes tight, then covers them with her hand. Can you give me one good reason why now, before it really gets bad? Why I shouldn't just take a bunch of pills? One good reason, Louise. Willie looks at Louise. His face is blank and turns to Eva, who now looks angry, defiant.
Well, he says to her gently, mornings are nice.
When I first read this passage, I too gave out a short chuckle over Willie's words, taking him to be in character with the slightly otherworldly way his creator, Miss Lamont, has given him of relating to the world. And I also read it as describing one of those situations I know we've probably all been in at one time or another, where you feel the need to say something, anything, and you end up blurting out a rather insipid remark that will later have you saying to yourself, God, I can't believe I actually said that. Something I know I have done my share of times. But I couldn't shake this passage off. And even as I continued on, you know, reading through the book here, I kept coming back to it. To the point that I decided that Mornings Are Nice really should have been the book's title. Although in the larger context of the novel, I mean, Joe Jones works about it as well. The phrase I finally got around to seeing was not the airheaded response on Willie's part that I first took it to be, even if Willie himself didn't grasp all that he was saying with his three somewhat desperately uttered words. And knowing I'd have an Easter sermon to write very soon after the end of my sabbatical, I further decided that Anne Lamont had given me my Easter scripture for this year, which is why I'm playing off of it. Let's take a look at it again. Eva has been brought face to face with the same reality of human mortality that all of us bear. In this case, it's accompanied by the loss of her closest relationship. It's just that in Eva's case, her mortality has suddenly come up right smack there in her face, to the point that she asks, not altogether irrationally, well, why not just cash it in now? And Willie's answer, however spacious it may sound at first hearing, speaks to the countervailing truth of our common mortality. And that is that life is still here for the living, still here for the savoring, for as long as we're given. That's the dual truth, the dual reality of the Easter message. Death is real, and sometimes cruel and inexplicable from our human perspective, which really is the only perspective we have, we can have, and life endures. None of us gets out of this world alive, even as our world and universe still give us our mornings of meaning and hope and possibility. Death is real, life endures. This is hardly a truth confined to any one religious faith or life stance, of course. Our earliest human ancestors knew it, or at least they sensed it in some way as they celebrated their earth-based rites of springtime and found the renewal of their spirits as a seemingly dead earth brought about its own resurrection of life. In fact, the very term for this day, Easter, as named on the Christian calendar, actually comes from those early pagan celebrations. Eos was the Greek goddess of the dawn. Estre, E-O-S-T-R-E, was an ancient fertility goddess. The Jewish Passover, which we recall with our Passover Seder here this past Thursday evening, also celebrates this same theme, but instead of a nature context, it celebrates the same theme in a human historical setting. And while the actual historical antecedents of Passover are forever lost, the legend that grew out of them is that of people finding new life, freedom, and liberation after they and their ancestors had endured the death in life of slavery and oppression. As for the Christian story or legend, what I see in that account, or what I see in that story, is the account of a man with the name of Jesus, which was a name about as common in his day as, well, Joe Jones here, who used the days he had, the mornings he was given, to both savor and attempt to save the world around him. He counseled his listeners to savor the beauty of the lilies, to hear the songs of the birds of the air, while also challenging them to use their energies and their efforts to set at liberty those who are oppressed. He taught about a certain kind of love and of a way of doing justice that transcended legalities and that transcended the barriers we human beings so easily erect between and amongst ourselves. He demonstrated the ways of healing and compassion and enlightenment to those who were receptive to his life and his message. And he was one of a number of evolved human beings who appear over the course of human history to show us who and what we might yet become. And, so the story goes, he got himself killed for his efforts. I spoke last Sunday about how I find the doctrine of vicarious atonement so graphically put forth in the film The Passion of Christ to be repugnant. I won't replay that today, other than to quickly reiterate my basic point that the saving dimension of Jesus' time on earth was his life, teachings, and example he left for us to learn from, and not his death, however horribly it may have been inflicted, to save us from a hopelessly fallen state. For me, the legend or the myth of the resurrection says the saving dimension of Jesus' life proved to be more enduring than the cruel reality of his death. That's what I was trying to tell our kids in another language or example this morning. And for all of the distortions, the doctrinal contortions, and the outright perversions that have been made of the religion that bears his name and that persists to this day, Jesus' message of love, justice, compassion, and forgiveness, understood within the context of the time and place in which he offered it, has its timeless qualities we would do well to heed. For it was the meaning of his life that overcame his death. And that, my friends, I would suggest to you, is the hope and the promise given to all of us on this nice morning. Not nice because of the weather, although it's kind of trying out there, or of a particular date that's on the calendar. Not even nice because the Sox won last night, although that was kind of nice. But it's because we have been given another morning that heralds another day in which we are given the opportunity to create meaning that will both nurture the lives we have and outlive them. And none of us know with complete certainty how many more such mornings we have. A few hundred, a few thousand, some tens of thousands probably for our younger set. It's all possibility, and wonderful possibility if we choose to treat it as such. My friend and now retired colleague in the UU ministry, the Reverend Richard Gilbert, once quipped in an address I heard him offer at a General Assembly some years ago, "I awake each morning torn between a desire to savor and save the world. This makes it a little difficult to plan my day." I don't know if that line is original with Dick or not, but it does set forth for us, I think, the challenge and the hope of meaningful living, and of living in relationship with that greater spirit of life, however we choose to sense and name it. Known to us by many names, it sustains and nurtures and calls us all. For in the face of the adversities and the sometimes inexplicable cruelties that life can visit upon us, and in the face of our own horrible human follies and failures of war and waste and destruction and injustice, we still live with the chance and opportunity to at least be a saving presence to that part of the world that's within our grasp. And we still live with the chance and the opportunity to savor life in such a way that we can be reassured that life is indeed worth the journey, for as long as the journey is ours to make. So what happened at Jesse's Cafe? Well, you know, it's my practice when I cite a work of fiction in a sermon. It's not my practice when I cite a work of fiction in a sermon to give it the ending. I'm prone to saying, well, you can go read the book for yourselves, but I'm going to bend that just a little bit this morning. I'll still leave you to go read the thing and figure out why the title is Joe Jones. Someone's death does take place before the story ends. But it's not Eva. Jesse, the founder and owner of a holy little hole in the wall of a restaurant, succumbs to the general vagaries of aging. And Willie mourns the loss of his mother, and Louise mourns the loss of her dearest friend, and through their grief, they decide that there still will be a Jesse's Cafe, and there is. And Jesse lives on among them, as these lines from the story show. Jesse, slowly, like the approach of a new season, comes back to the cafe. Louise finds herself talking to her again, teasing her. She keeps expecting her to return from the bathroom. She can feel the old woman watching Willie. Sometimes from within, sometimes from the outside and above. And for this reason only, Louise is kind to the cats. As for Eva, well, she does not get better. She does not make a miraculous recovery. That's not the way Anne Lamott writes. But Eva does outlive the novel, at least. She decides to go with her mourning, and she takes off to reconnect with what family she has and to savor what life there is for her to savor, and she sends some postcards back to the cafe. First one reads, "There are a million ducks up here. I'm with my brother and nieces with a view of Mount Rainier and the lake. I love your letter, Louise, and I love all of you." The last postcard she sent reads, "I'm on a train to Alaska now. It's unbelievably beautiful outside my window. I saw a bald eagle this morning. I am fine because of you. I send all my love, E." And that's the last we'll hear of Eva Dean, as far as Ms. Lamott's telling of the story goes. How her life finally ends is left to the mind of the reader. Well, I'm a little hesitant to try getting into the mind of such a talented writer as the author of Joe Jones and several other wonderful books that she's written. But I did wonder, when I finished reading it, why she has Eva just kind of riding off into some beautiful scenery. And I decided, after thinking on that for a while, that it was neither a romanticization nor a denial of death on Lamont's part. I take it instead as a message that how we get to the last of the mornings we're given is far more important than when we get there, or what specifically happens when we do get there. Each of our mornings is a day of resurrection. So may we find the means and the wisdom and the courage treat them as such. A very blessed and happy Easter to each of you. Closing.